This is HBR News number 207. Giving up your phones for justice, dying for the environment, and banning handshakes. Where we reflect on the stories of the week and give it the Badger treatment. Hello, everybody, and welcome to Honey Badger Radio. I'm your host, Brian, and I'm joined by, as always, my esteemed panelist, Hannah and the one Mike. Mike J is not available. He's off watching Infinity War with a friend. Or whatever that last movie was that people are talking about. And so I just have Dr. Random Cam and Hannah, which is...
I am the one mic to rule them all and in the darkness bind them.
And just hopefully we aren't in a there could be only one situation, because that could get ugly.
That's right. We have a great show lined up for you guys today, so please be sure to continue the conversations both in the chat as well as the comments section. On this week's HBR News Show, we're going to be talking about the honks of the week, from police forcing accusers to share their phone info for evidence to workplaces possibly banning handshakes in order to prevent sexual harassment claims to the synagogue shooting and more. So stick around, it's going to be a good time. And be sure to join us afterwards for the patron-only after show. If you support, this is a quote from the article I'm going to be reading in the after show. I had to do some digging to find this, but... It's probably going to have some lulls in it. If you support Bernie Sanders, then you are probably an entitled young white guy, a Bernie bro, someone who purports to support progressive ideas, but is really a raging misogynist who could never vote for a woman. We heard this message ad infinitum during the 2016 primaries. I wonder why. Gloria Steinem herself even accused young female Sanders supporters of only supporting him over Hillary Clinton because, quote, the boys are with Bernie, end quote, which was an incredibly bizarre thing for a feminist to say. So fortunately, that was a quote from the article we'll be reading about. It's a good thing, though, that the writer of this Guardian opinion piece, Arwa Madawi, is apparently more woke on feminism than Gloria Steinem and Hillary Clinton, and she's going to femsplain to us why Bernie Sanders is the most feminist 2020 candidate. We will look at the details after today's show, so be sure to join us. Anyway, if you'd like to participate in our after shows, either as an audience member or a participant, please consider becoming a patron or badger yourself by going to www.feedthebadger.com for a monthly subscription. And if you don't want to wake up one morning to find yourself unable to find our content because YouTube finally dropped the axe on our channels, please go to badgerfeed.com. That's badgerfeed.com to find all things HBR. Okay. So, looks like the video output on YouTube is a little bit low. I don't know why that is, because my upload is just fine. So, if you are running into any issues with... you know, let's say buffering and so on, just try lowering the resolution down from HD. That might work. So try that, see if it works better. But I don't know, there's some kind of choke going on in the world of YouTube that I can't really control. So everything's fine on my end. So let's get into the stories. We're going to start with, it was a little bit of a slow news week, but there was some interesting stuff that happened. All right. Mick Jagger is in the news. The legendary band, the Rolling Stones, had to postpone several dates of their current tour after the band's frontman, Mick Jagger, needed heart surgery earlier in April. The surgery, which was to replace a heart valve, went well, and Jagger is reportedly on the mend. Guitarist for the band, Ronnie Wood, explained how he and fellow bandmate Keith Richards have tried to keep Jagger in good spirits. Quote, Sally and I went on a break to the Caribbean with Keith and his wife, Patty, and sent him videos of us playing and singing Get Well songs on the guitar. That cracked him up. We're all so pleased that he's doing well. End quote. The Rolling Stones hope to resume their tour in July. Holy shit, can this man, like, is he unkillable? I know that Keith Richards is the one that's supposed to be unkillable, but he must be sharing some of his, like, necromantic energy to the other members. but there was some talk that he...
I think they all got cursed by the same leprechaun that night.
Yeah. There was talk that, you know, he would in much bigger trouble, but he's still kicking. And I got to tell you that really says something, considering the lifestyle and everything. that he was able to, I guess, just stay alive. So congratulations, and I hope that Mick Jagger does well. We've lost a lot of sort of rock legends, all of them male, by the way, in the last few years, like Lemmy from Motorhead, and we lost David Bowie, and the list goes on. So anyway, so I'm happy for him. But like, speaking of dinosaurs, though, an odd sign happened recently at the Kelvington Grove Art Gallery in Glasgow, Scotland. Roughly 300 activists collapsed around a famous Diplodocus. I hope I'm saying that correctly. A famous Diplodocus skeleton nicknamed Dippy the Dinosaur, in an effort to raise awareness about the extinction of the human race. That's right. Raising awareness about the extinction of the human race. The event was organized by a group known as We Rebellion, which is a smaller branch, you might say a wee branch, of the larger group Extinction Rebellion that focuses on younger activists. The protest lasted just minutes before those involved left. The group threatens that these kinds of protests will continue until the government, quote, tells the truth, end quote, about climate change. One 12-year-old protester gave her reasons for what she did, stating, quote, "We want to raise awareness about climate change. If we keep carrying on the way we are, humans may become extinct like Dippy," end quote. Just kind of like two silly little stories. I mean, one of them, you know, the Rolling Stones one it was good news overall. And made me wonder, like, how old is this guy now? Is he like in his 80s? And then the one about the dinosaur, which I just thought was silly. It reminded me of, I saw another protest like this where I think there were a bunch of climate/vegan protesters that all played dead in a grocery store or a mall, and they were all just laying around.
Yeah, someone brought their kid along. There was like a 5-year-old kid in there.
Yes, yes.
It was just made to lie down on the filthy floor of a supermarket. It's like, guys.
Well, there was also the Florida kids, the ones that are protesting gun control after their school shooting. They have invaded several stores and laid on the floor for hours protesting.
Mm-hmm.
Usually when kids do that, it's called a temper tantrum.
That's probably why they brought the child. It's more like a consultant.
There you go.
What do we do in this situation?
Now, did they just lay there, or did they kick and go, "I want the big candy bar"?
It's a good question. I think they just laid there, played dead. It was at the supermarket thing was adults, but the dinosaur one was kids, although under adult supervision. You know, because they're sort of, you know, getting them involved in activism early, I guess. And I mean, I think in a way that was the I don't really have a flag. You know, I haven't planted my flag on anything. This, like, climate change is not the hill I would die on. I don't know much about it. I think there's a lot of narratives, you know, all over the place. And I guess I don't think it's the most pressing issue for me. But the reason why I brought it up. Thank you, Grimhall, for subscribing. The reason why I bring the story up is more so about how there are these groups, these political groups that mobilize to engage in activism, and they're getting kids involved in activism as early as possible. And for me, that's a bit troubling, because most of the time when there is activism, most of the time it's coming from one direction. It's like the establishment direction. And even as a person who advocates for men, I don't want to drag children into the red pill world. I don't want to do that.
If the people doing the activism don't really understand what the cause is, then you might be exploiting those people, or at least you sort of gone about it in a weird way. Like I said once in a video a while ago about the red poppy thing, like they introduce kids to those at a very young age, and then you put on the poppy, and at the time I had no idea. I couldn't possibly explain what the poppy was about when I was that young, because what it's about is so dark in its details. So it's a bit weird to get kids involved in that if, because it is an empty gesture if they don't understand what it's about. And I'm really not convinced these kids know why they're all playing dead around a statue of a Diplodocus. Like, it's a weird sort of 4D language, like they're talking to aliens in some sort of symbology.
does anyone else have any other thoughts on this before we move on to the next? These are just a little bitty stories.
When it comes to activism, you educate your kids. You don't necessarily shove them into the public eye. Like, that's kind of not necessary. When they start to want to participate in what you're doing, and because they understand it and they're passionate about it, then they're ready. And if they're not, if it's not their idea to get involved, then they're not ready. I started getting involved with Ohio Right to Life when I was 13, but that was after a lot of reading and a lot of asking my grandmother questions. Grandma was a nurse, so she was the best person to go to in the family with medical questions. And the more I learned about it, the more passionate I became about the issue. But yeah, it wasn't until I asked to go with my grandparents to an Ohio Right to Life event that they started taking me. They didn't ever try to make me go. I drew my own conclusions, and when I was ready, I got started in it. And I think that's the way it should be. I don't think parents should force their kids to do that kind of thing or use them as props and that kind of thing, because it's really going to come back later and bite them in the butt.
Let's move on to the next story, and I'll have to look into this later. I am going to be getting fiber, hopefully this week, so this should hopefully be rectified. I find that, you know, it's more stable.
You must be doing that on purpose. Fiber rectified.
I was just going to make a joke about that too. You know what happens when you hit middle age? You always need more fiber.
That's great. Okay, so what was I saying? Oh yeah, so we're gonna move on to the next story. We're gonna be talking about, this is actually, these are the interesting ones, so hopefully you guys will get more engaged. We're gonna be talking about, well, this new, I think it's gonna be a new policy. Let's take a look. Public outrage over a collapse of rape cases has sparked England and Wales to implement a quote national disclosure improvement plan. A series of rape cases in 2017 were thrown out after the discovery of new messages and photos. The goal of this plan is to improve the way potential evidence is shared between officers, prosecutors, and defense lawyers. Earlier this year, complainants were handed new forms warning those who refuse to surrender their digital devices or prevent any personal information from being shared that, quote, it may not be possible for the investigation or prosecution to continue, end quote. In other words, as the Independent reports, quote, rape and domestic violence claims will be forced to give police access to their phones and social media accounts or face their cases being dropped. However, it isn't just rape victims this will and has been applied to. Digital devices can be demanded from anyone reporting a crime, but because sexual offenses are often committed without witnesses or other evidence, they are more likely to be necessary. Before the plan, complainants reported that they were being told their attackers will not be their attackers will not be, because if they do not, or they will, I'm sorry, they will not be prosecuted if they do not hand over their phones. Police and prosecutors say the forms make the process clearer. Quote, they give consent for police to download the contents of digital devices, including phones, laptops, tablets, and smartwatches, and to examine messages, call data, photographs, emails, internet browsing history, apps, and social media accounts. The document adds, quote, we recognize that only the reasonable lines of inquiry should be pursued to avoid unnecessary intrusion into the personal lives of individuals, end quote, inviting victims to specify what data or time period they think is relevant. The victim's commissioner, Baroness Newlove, is not sure this is a good thing, saying victims of sexual violence were being re-traumatized by routinely having their personal lives disproportionately investigated and disclosed in criminal trials. Another quote from The Independent reads as follows. Many victims will not just be in a position to fully understand the implications of signing over their personal data. It is a huge decision to take at any time, let alone when you are at your most vulnerable. She called for victims to be offered free access to independent legal advice and for judges, rather than detectives or prosecutors, to decide what must be disclosed in disputes. Quote, changing the paperwork might improve the efficiency of the process, but it does not deliver fairness for victims, end quote, according to Baroness Newlove. Lastly, another quote from The Independent, this form is unlikely to do anything to help reverse the fall in prosecutions for rape and sexual violence. I am concerned it might have the opposite effect, with even fewer victims willing to pursue their cases through to trial. Okay, so there is this big conversation around the idea that essentially what the prosecutors are asking for, police, is access to people's social media accounts, phones, computers, laptops, tablets, and other devices so that they can try to corroborate evidence.
In the event that they accuse someone of a violent crime. And I'm sort of sat here thinking, so that wasn't already the case?
Well, here's the problem. This is I know why this is happening. This is happening because of how many times people have lied to the police. And they wouldn't be pursuing this if it weren't for the fact that false accusations of this type of crime are common. They wouldn't do this if this kind of accusation was rarely false. And they especially wouldn't do it if this kind of evidence wasn't knocking down their cases by surprise. You know, like, they're blindsided by it because the accuser is not telling them, well, yeah, I have text messages that prove that I was fine with it. She's not going to do that if she's going in there and lying to them about being raped, right? But this is a huge invasion of privacy, and if it was the other way, if they were saying, well, if you're accused of these crimes, you have to turn over all this information, we would be screaming from the hills about due process and the right to protection from unlawful search and seizure. They should have to have just cause for digging into this information regardless. And there is a better approach to dealing with the fact that accusers are lying about this stuff and then it's coming out during the case and the police are getting their asses handed to them because they didn't know that the accuser had text messages proving she was actually fine with the encounter. And that is, you get the victim, you know, the alleged victim, to the person coming in and making an accusation has to sign under oath. If that were made law, that they would have to sign under oath that they don't have anything that would counter their case, you know, that they can attest that the accused isn't going to come back with text messages that say, you know, hey, I had a great time last night, let's do it again, then they can go to jail if that information comes out. And that's the way it's going to, you know, have to be in terms of stopping power, because, like, you're not going to stop accusers from lying to cops by making them turn over all this information. They'll just clean their shit, you know, so they don't have any of that information in their history. And then they'll go in and they'll tell their lies thinking that that gets rid of it, and not realizing that if they communicated to the accused, a lot of the different forms of communication, the accused will still have his end of that communication, and the platform on which the communication was sent can produce evidence that that communication actually happened, and then they're going to be in trouble for obstruction of justice. So this is a bad way to handle the situation. I understand why they're doing it, and the reason they're doing it is compelling. It is wrong that false accusations are this common. And it's definitely wrong that this evidence is not coming to light until after the taxpayer-funded system has been activated and money has been spent on these investigations and the accused has had to face these accusations and his life is damaged and all that. But the only real way to deter that is going to be to actually uphold the penalties for wasting police time. I think in the UK it's different. They have different names for everything, but lying to police during an investigation, filing a false charge, perjury, those all have to be enforced in these cases. And if they're not going to enforce those, it's not going to matter if they dig into the accuser's history. They could look at everything the accuser has, communication-wise, and it's not going to be any skin off the accuser's nose. Because there's already laws in place that, you know, you can use a rape accusation as a shield against prosecution for everything else. Even if they don't prosecute for the accusation. So if you're trying to cover up that you were buying drugs or doing something else illegal, you make a rape accusation, they can't prosecute you for anything they find anyway, right? So they're not going to care about that. But they'll care if they find out that if they go in and file a false complaint and there's evidence that comes out from the other side that the complaint was not only false, but the accuser knew it was false, they're going to get prosecuted for lying to the police. That's the only deterrent that's really going to matter.
The other thing I was going to say about this is this seems to be a response to a phony statistic. So there's a desire to essentially try to increase the rate at which rapists are convicted, and then so by extension, rape victims are protected or they get justice. But where they're working from is this idea that The Independent put out. They say figures released last week show that only 1.7% of reported rapes were prosecuted in 2018, and 40% of cases were closed with the marker evidential difficulties, victim does not support action. So they didn't get... Apparently, they didn't get like what they might have needed to be able to acquire additional evidence. But this 1.7% number is extremely misleading because it works from the assumption that, that there's so many rapists that are essentially getting away with it without considering that maybe a rape didn't take place. Maybe, you know, this is they're saying that there are too many men being acquitted. And that's a problem. So how do we fix it? Well, why don't we invade the privacy of the victims and basically look at their stuff? And of course, the people that had the largest problem with the police and essentially wanting to go through all their devices are feminists that don't want them to do that. Hence that statement where the feminist was like, well, it was like the Duke or whatever she was, Baroness. She said that you're basically causing these women to re-experience their trauma. So what it sounds like to me is happening is this misleading statistic is put out there that basically says you're not convicting enough rapists. And so the cops are like, okay, so maybe what we should do is we should essentially, we should just have access to your devices so we can look at your stuff so that we can gather evidence so that we can, you know, follow due process. Maybe this will make things a lot easier. And then there are, people coming forward like this politician or whatever saying, well, you can't do that because it bothers women to make them go through all that all over again. So it's like, okay, so what do you really want? And I'm almost inclined to believe that what they really want is just to be able to throw men in jail when a woman points the finger and says something because we don't want to look too
exactly
closely
what
at
they
her.
Want.
Yeah. So.
Well, this is the thing. Okay. So first of all, that number, that's what are they saying? 1.5% or something like that?
1.7% of reported rapes were actually prosecuted, which tells me not a lot of rapes going on. I mean.
First thing, if that is the rain statistic, they're not talking about rapes that were reported to the police. They're talking about rapes that were reported to, like, shelters and crime victim services and you know, places like Rain, not actual police complaints. Like, so that's the beginning of it. They have this statistic that makes it look like there's this huge epidemic of unreported rape. Like, more than half of the statistic is made up of rape complaints that were never reported to the police in the first place.
Well, this number, according to the link, says it's these are rapes prosecuted in England and Wales. So okay. It might not be related to Rain, because I think that's an American.
Well, does it actually? No.
Is it?
Because the Rain statistic is actually UK as well.
There's no citation. I don't see a link. Yeah, unfortunately, there's no links or citations. This number is just put out there.
That's part of the problem with these articles. They very frequently fail to deal with the actual statistics. The link to for the word rape in the article goes to, so a lot of the statistic where I've seen this before, it comes from Rain, and it is based on the cost survey method. It's based on estimates by workers at like victim services and places, rape crisis centers and stuff like that, where they don't necessarily report to the police. And that's part of the statistic is how few of the alleged rapes are reported to the police. So you eliminate more than half of the statistic by just discounting. If it's not reported to the police, they can't prosecute, can they? And then you get it, you reduce that by that much, and you end up with something like, you know, double the percentage, like 3.6% right out of the chute, because that's just the ones that are reported to the police. Well, then the other thing is you have victims, or alleged victims anyway, that won't cooperate. Part of the reason some of them won't cooperate is because if the police dig too deep, they will find out the accuser lied. And this is something else. There is evidence from a variety of studies that it ranges from, at the strictest standard for deeming something false, 8%. That's the lowest number. The highest number is like 65%. And actually, there are some numbers above that that aren't necessarily all that credible. But I've seen some studies that actually rate it higher than 65%. So, if you eliminate all of the potential false cases, you apply that number across the board to all of the accusations, then you're reducing it even further. So when they say 1.7% of rapes resulted in a charge or a summons, 1.7% of rapes gets convicted or whatever, they're counting false accusations and unreported allegations that might not have been crimes, questionable cases and things like that, in as rapes. That's completely inaccurate and very dishonest.
Yeah, absolutely. It's like it's the usual stuff. Like I've been saying lately, you know, that the war on words. You start saying something, you start broadening the definition of rape, or you broaden the you use looser words, like you say only 1.7% of reported rapes, and it makes people react in a certain way, but it leaves out a lot of truth. It's using a small amount of truth to tell a very big lie, and it's not helpful. And it's not helpful for another reason, like throw a bone to, you know, actual rape victims, which obviously, you know, I sympathize with. This doesn't help them because it does make people a lot more skeptical. And rape is a very difficult crime to prove when it happens. You know, it can be anyway. And so to try to like expand on it, to make it into a much more widespread epidemic when the scale at which it happens should not matter when it comes to the actual you know, trauma. And then you do that, by the way, while simultaneously erasing half of the population by saying men can't be raped. They only do the raping. You just make it very difficult to talk about something as serious as rape in an honest way. So
you just want to say phrasing on the thing about throwing a bone to rape victims.
Oh, I mean, only if they want it, only if they want the bone. I don't want to give them a bone they don't want. That would be rape.
There we go. That would be rape. Yes. There are some things that we take as a society, as gospel, that we shouldn't. One of them is that rape is a very hard crime to prove. It is damn near impossible to get into the kind of fight where you pin somebody down and there's a struggle and you don't leave some DNA behind. And it's damn near impossible to physically subdue somebody against their will without injuring them. And so there are defensive wounds are evidence. All right. And now I'm not saying that makes it 100% easy to they're not necessarily easier to prosecute than other assaults are, but I don't think rape is that much more difficult to prosecute than other assaults. I think what happens is all accusers are vehement in their insistence that their accusation is 100% true. Right, and all accusers are going to be absolutely 100% invested in maintaining that. So they're not going to come back and say, "Well, maybe it wasn't really rape. Maybe I just regret it." Right? They're not going to do that. So if they had an encounter with somebody and they engaged in a sex act, or they didn't say no, they didn't reject the sexual advances of their partner in any way, and then they come back later and say, "Well, but I didn't consent," when in fact their actions were consent, then it's hard to prove that there was a rape because there wasn't one. And the biggest problem with supposedly that supposedly causes rape to be hard to prove is that our society has taken mens rea out of it. So now, instead of the accused, basically in an actual rape, instead of an actual rapist being someone who deliberately contravenes the victim's refusal, either using physical force, using means of coercion, like a threat of physical force, a threat of violence, or a threat of something so compelling that the person cannot resist, cannot refuse, you know, or using drugs or coming across somebody that's passed out and taking advantage, you know, those things are actually contravention of the victim's ability to refuse or right to refuse. Those, I'm comfortable calling all of those things rape, right? But when you're in a situation where they both had a beer and they're both a little tipsy, and they have sex, and she comes back later and says, "Well, that was rape because I couldn't consent." Or when she goes along with a sex act and then comes back later and says, "Well, I wasn't enthusiastic about it. I didn't want to do that, and you didn't ask." That's not rape. And I don't care how much flack I get for saying that. The guy is not deliberately contravening your right or ability to refuse. You don't know that he wouldn't have stopped if you said, "I don't want to do this." So you don't have a right to impute malice on him. And of course it's hard to prove that was rape, because it's not. It's not rape. It's stupid. And this is one of the reasons why I get really upset about these myths that, you know, rape is impossible or damn near impossible to prove or hard to prove, and most rapes aren't reported to police and most rapes aren't prosecuted and all that. That's feminists trying to convince women that everything men do to them is predatory and that they're helpless to communicate and enforce their own personal boundaries and that we have to be afraid all the time. None of those things are true. It's bullshit, and we really should not accept any of those myths.
Well, I guess when I mean, I agree with the whole, like, you know, I wouldn't say that it's impossible to prove or near impossible to prove. And there certainly is, like, violent rape, like you said, you know, there's definitely evidence. I was thinking about more so in cases where someone, you know, intentionally drugs or gets someone else drunk, or, you know, or has sex with a like someone underneath them, like a teacher and their student, even if they're both of age. And I guess that maybe in that case, it's not rape so much. But in cases where there is not going to be any evidence of a struggle, but rather it's more like, you know, oh, I went home with this person and I, you know, or we were at a party and we went into the other room to have some drinks or smoke some weed. And there was, I think there was something in it. And maybe those aren't common. But I think that, and at the same time, I think that it can be difficult possibly to prove those kinds of rapes, but I'm not saying that in a way to abdicate a person's personal responsibility to try to avoid putting themselves in those situations. In fact, I think that the knowledge that some kinds of crime, not just rape, certain kinds of crime can be very difficult to prove because they won't, the evidence won't be as sort of easy to find, is more cause for people to try to take personal responsibility. Because we don't want to treat, we don't want to live in a world where we treat crime as though it is, you know, like a sickness where you just wait until the symptoms get bad and then you just go to the doctor. But rather, we should be thinking about them in a way that is more preventative, where you take the initiative and try to keep yourself from being in that situation. And I'm being specific and careful to not gender the language, because I think that this can also apply to men. If there's a woman that wants to, and we've seen stories about it, a woman that wants to rape a man, you know, she can do so without actually making it violent. And I think that after it's over, I think that it can be difficult to prove that it took place. In fact, it's probably even more difficult for a man, since we're working around how we define rape, as well as, you know, trying to find evidence. The DNA thing might be helpful, but...
Yeah, I was going to say, that's the thing. DNA being left behind is proof that the encounter happened. And a lot of times women will use coercion, things like that, and a lot of times there's evidence of the attempt to coerce. Not always, but there are ways to prove. Now, I would say it might be more difficult to prove rape in the case where the victim is male and the perpetrator is female, but it's definitely not so difficult with a woman as the victim. And I, even with the case of drugs and alcohol, it's almost impossible to get somebody drunk without their knowledge, unless they're already a heavy drinker. Because if you're not a heavy drinker and somebody slips alcohol, even alcohol that people think is tasteless, you can taste it if you're not used to consuming alcohol. It has a heat to it. Even if it's in something really sugary, which is really gross, by the way, you can still taste it. It still has a heat to it. Now, it can be, if you're used to drinking and you know you're drinking alcohol, you can drink alcohol and it can end up being a little stronger than you expected. And your metabolism can change. You can have different things happen with your metabolism. But that goes back to responsible drinking. And again, if you're capable of participating in the sex act, you're not unconscious. And if you are unconscious, you know, unless the guy is like, what's his name from the bad guy from the novel, The Dead Zone by Stephen King, he's going to leave behind DNA evidence. And so you could prove that the encounter happened. And you can get your blood alcohol level checked afterwards. You know, if you wake up and you discover that you have been taken advantage of, you get your blood alcohol level checked then, and even if it's hours after the fact, they know that when it happened, you were drunker than that. If you go, you know, if you've been knocked out, if you've been unconscious, or you've had something weird happen, you know, like your perceptions all went wonky and stuff like that, in a way that's not consistent with alcohol use, and you suspect you were drugged, you go to the hospital. You should do that anyway. It's, you don't know what was in your system. You don't know if you've been poisoned. I mean, drugs basically are sort of a poison. So you should go to the hospital. And if you suspect you've been taken advantage of, you get a rape kit done. You know, the best way to fix a lot of these problems is to put, get the rape kit testing in control of both the accuser and the accused, and then also the prosecutor. Basically, if anybody of those three says this needs to be processed, it has to be processed, and the losing side of the case has to foot the bill for it at the end of the case. But aside from that, no, it's a lot more scientific than people think. You know, proving something like that happened, and it does. A lot of it goes back to DNA and blood testing and documenting your whereabouts during the night, witness testimony as to who was where. And you know, things like that. And it's... I cannot accept the feminist assertion that we need to make rape easier to prosecute because it's hard to prove. And I think the basis for that it's harder to prove than other crimes, is false.
Yeah, fair enough. Oh, I think that's... yeah, that's fair. So I got a super chat I want to read out real quick. Newcomers to making false... This is Zeranx, by the way. Gives us $5. He says, newcomers to making false accusations are cursing the false accusers that came before them and couldn't construct a more believable lie. Thank you, Zeranx, for the $5. Yeah, there was a little bit of buffering. I don't know why that is. My thing seems fine. Actually, the YouTube is green now, so we're good to go. We've been for a little while. But yeah, so I guess at the end of the day, you know, personal accountability should reign supreme. We shouldn't necessarily depend on the state to simply take care of all of our problems, because the world's a messy place and you should be sort of like, you know, acting responsibly. And I think that this is the issue we're running into. So in a way, I think that this policy, I don't like the idea of invasion of privacy, but in a way, I can understand why this policy is being pushed, because there's all of this hysteria around this crime. And I think that they're trying to accommodate people who just want to make false accusations or have been convinced that a rape took place when it actually didn't, or something like that. Because if you went through their actual social media, you might find evidence that it was untrue, or you might find evidence that they didn't actually, you know, that they actually wanted to have sex with this person. It's kind of like the Gian Gomeshi story, where they went through his, or he submitted evidence of, you know, online discussions he had with the women that wanted to see him again, and they wanted to do anal and all kinds of other stuff. And it kind of like made the whole case break down. So, however, with that said, let us know what you guys think about the story. And I'm going to move on to the next story. So let us know what you guys think about that story in the comments section below. All right. Next up, we have, you guys might have heard about this. Last Saturday morning, on the last day of Passover, a gunman opened fire at a Southern California synagogue, injuring 3 and killing 1. The shooting took place at the Chabad of Poway Synagogue, located in San Diego, California. The shooter, identified as 19-year-old John T. Ernest, fled the scene after being confronted by Oscar Stewart, an Army veteran, and Jonathan Morales, an off-duty Border Patrol agent, who fired 4 shots at Ernest's car as he fled. Minutes later, Ernest contacted police admitting to the crime and was soon after arrested. The shooting claimed the life of Lori Gilbert Kay, a 60-year-old member of the congregation who jumped in front of the synagogue's founding rabbi, In an effort to shield him from the attack, the rabbi, as well as an unknown 34-year-old man and child, were also treated to injuries and are treated for injuries and gunshot wounds. All three are expected to recover. At this time, the motive for the shooting appears to be eerily similar to that of the Christchurch mosque attacker. 20 minutes before the attack, Ernest allegedly published his manifesto online, in which he discussed his hatred for Jews and Muslims, praised another synagogue shooter, and quoted Hitler in a positive light. Ernest's parents were shocked by their son's actions, as he seemed to have a bright future ahead of himself, being an accomplished pianist and honor student. In a statement released by the parents, they have stated their willingness to cooperate fully with investigators. Well, this is not good, obviously. These things taking place, they are, they come across as evidence that something is breaking down in our society. We have really lost the plot. And I can't defend this man's actions. Obviously, what he did was terrible. But I gotta question why this is happening. Why is this happening with men, young men today? They seem aimless. They seem to, maybe they're reacting to something, like to this sort of current narrative that's been going around. I don't know. I can't. It's hard to talk about without appearing to sympathize. I don't like what this person did. I think this is actually making things worse. If this person is doing this in the name of the Christchurch shooter, it's intended to make things escalate. And this is not good, because the problem too is that these groups like the SPLC and the Anti-Defamation League and the mainstream media, they're going to use this and we're never going to hear the end of it. And it's just going to be used as another bludgeon to essentially attack regular American men that just want to, you know, live a regular life and get on with things and try to, you know, enjoy, like, pursue their goals uninhibited. And I think this is just going to make things worse. I don't know. But
I guess what I would point out about this is this, like, ABC pointed out, and I think a couple of other sources did too, that this guy had been, he was not radicalized, and then all of a sudden he was. It had happened really quickly over the course of like a year, and no actual clues. Like his parents had no idea that this was happening to him. He just you know, adopted this ideology and then ran with it and just descended into it at top speed. The question then becomes, how? You know, where did this happen? You know, was this something that he was part of, groups communicating this, a bunch of stuff that, was false to each other, or was he at a church, you know, or at a mosque that was particularly known to be spouting radical bullshit, as opposed to peace and love? You know, was he in a forum that where he was radicalized? Because if he was in a forum, they should be able to, unless, you know, like if it was a place like Gab, they would have the evidence that they could provide. But if it was Facebook or Twitter, those guys hide the evidence when somebody gets radicalized on their sites.
Yeah, I mean, word is 8chan might have been involved in some way, in the same way that they were kind of involved with Christchurch. But it's hard to say. Like, that's what I've heard. It was like image boards, like 8chan or 4chan. That, but like, I don't know if that, like, to radicalize him though. I see.
Well, And the only thing that they've said is that he frequented 8chan, but they didn't know if that was where the information came from. So it becomes a question again, like, where did the information, or where did what he decided was true and real, that he decided was compelling enough to persuade him to do this? Whatever that, you know.
Yeah, I was just going to say, I think it's a combination of things. This is why I chose this story, because my concern is that what's happening is that you're, okay, so like, you're a young man and you're, you know, this guy was supposedly an honor student and his future, you know, could have been bright, I suppose. He is just like the Christchurch guy. He had both his parents and the whole bit, right? And you see online that you are attacked constantly, not just online, but in real life, for your gender, for your race, for your politics, perhaps, whatever. But there are people constantly going after you for who you are. And this is a mainstream, you know, way of doing things. This is like very divisive. And you go to school and you experience the same thing, because your teachers most likely are towing that same line. And you've been raised, even though you're a boy, when you go to get educated, you're going under a feminized system. And I think that when you do that, you push these men so far away that they just end up finding each other in this sort of toxic part of the internet, where they're trying to, first off, make sense of what's going on. And then they start getting angry and frustrated. And they want to do something about it. And sometimes it means that they, you know, maybe they start a YouTube channel and they start complaining about this shit online, or they make fun of it. You know, they get it, they start using the Clown World meme or whatever. But I think occasionally you get people like this that become absolutely nihilistic. They feel like they need to do something self-destructive to make a point.
Like, the question is, do we have, you know, something to trace back the process of his radicalization? And then the reason that it's important to be able to trace that back is because if you can unpack or untangle the process of radicalization, you can figure out how to prevent it.
Uh-huh. Oh, yeah, sure.
But one of the problems that we have right now is, again, most social media sites, especially now because of the reaction to Gab preserving the evidence and providing it to law enforcement so that they could actually use it, other social media sites promoted the narrative that made Gab a Nazi site. The fact that the evidence could be seen on their site after the fact, that made them a Nazi site, according to these other social media sites. Now, they have like half of the anti-Semitic rhetoric that is posted on Twitter. A lot of the anti-Semitic rhetoric, at least a lot of the anti-Jewish rhetoric, a lot of the anti-Semitic rhetoric on Twitter comes from other Semites. That's pretty bad, but it's true. Like, a lot of Twitter's anti-Jewish rhetoric comes from Muslims, and a lot of YouTube's anti-Jewish rhetoric comes from Muslims. A lot of Facebook's anti-Jewish rhetoric comes from Muslims, and vice versa. And I mean, that's those two religions have been at war with each other forever, and that's not going to stop because social media exists, right? But when somebody is part of one of those other social media sites and they post things that could help authorities and basically first, not just first responders, but the mental health community and their families and anybody that might be helpful, trace back, this is how they went from, I'm good in society and I'm gonna get my education and get a job, or I'm gonna learn a trade and get a job, or I'm gonna graduate high school and get a job, to I'm gonna go kill people. And this is what we need to address. This series of events, or these factors, these contributing factors, are what we need to. And instead of being able to do that, they have nothing because it gets deleted. That needs to change. And we need to stop demonizing sites that preserve the evidence simply because they don't censor.
Yeah, absolutely. One other thing, too, is that what will probably come out of this that's pretty dark, but you can expect it, is now that this has taken place, it will be used as an excuse to police the internet more. They'll be fine. There's going to be calls to get rid of websites like Gab and take down websites like 4chan and 8chan and whatever else that they suspect.
Already are.
Yeah, that they're definitely going to use this as ammunition against that. And by the way, this event is also, this is not like something we didn't see coming, but you can expect more rhetoric coming out of the mainstream media about how this is an example of toxic masculinity, about how this is, you know, this guy is a red pill incel. And, you know, I think that Takedown MRA has already said that this guy is, you know, clearly an MRA or part of the MRA thing. And I know Takedown MRAs is a really stupid Twitter, but the point is the rhetoric is getting out there because, you know, even though I think that in part, this demonization of men, young men, specifically white men, but all men in general, it's just like a matter of what order they do it in, is definitely contributing to this issue of nihilistic men that feel like they don't have a place in this world. And so they should just act out. They should just, you know, lash out in some way. And this is only in the cases when this happens. Most of the time, men are just going to self-destruct slowly. Most of the time, they might just hang themselves or shoot themselves. But in the few cases where they feel like they're just going to like do a lot of damage to try to make a point, or maybe they've kind of accepted their their bigotry because they've been told they're bigots all this time just by virtue of being born, you know, a male with a certain skin color, and they decide, well, you know what, I'm just going to act on that then. This is what you get. I mean, it's unfortunate, but this is where we are, and we need to help our men. This is like the only way you're going to avoid more of these is to do that. No amount of policing the internet, no amount of demonization of men is going to make this better. And this is just going to get worse. So,
no, in fact, policing the internet will make it worse because it'll actually exacerbate some of the problems that are leading to it. It'll drive the people who are seeking specifically to radicalize, because there are people out there that are seeking to radicalize young men and take advantage of their discontent and their feeling of being alone and so on. And it's not just radical Islam. Like every radical group out there exploits young men this way in one way or another. It's just that radical Islam is the most famous for it. And I think there's a great deal more death and destruction associated with that right now. And actually, there were two incidents. One got widely reported, and the other one didn't. The other one, the San Diego Union-Tribune did report on it, and that was Mark Stephen Domingo, an Army veteran, who was actually also radicalized. He was actually radicalized into extremist Islam, not, you know, your everyday average mosque you see people going in and out of every day and nobody does anything wrong, but actual he expressed allegiance to ISIS, and he had planned a mass bombing. He had planned, essentially, he was making bombs that would spew out shrapnel. He had bought 3-inch nails to put in his bombs to puncture people and so on. And he got caught because he tried to purchase from an FBI agent. So they were already watching him. They already had an idea what he was doing and everything. So the FBI foiled his plot. But this was reported. Okay, this is definitely at your end because I'm showing complete green at my end. But yeah, this was re- Yeah, this was reported on the 29th, on April 29th. So this reported yesterday, and I have seen almost no discussion of it whatsoever. Whereas, obviously, like, takedown MRAs is all on this other one because he's not. He wasn't an Islamic extremist. Or at least nobody is saying that he was. He hated both equally, if I understand right. So he was actually really, he was screwed up in a different direction. But it seems rather selective, don't you think, in terms of attention, to pay attention to one and not the other. The fact that the one was thwarted doesn't change the terror of what he was planning to do. He was going to set off a bomb. What did it say here? He was planning actually on attacking a white nationalist parade or something, but he was planning on hitting several Southern California mass casualties or several locations to cause mass casualties, according to law enforcement officials. So this is like, you have the one guy that everybody wants to talk about because he apparently was a white nationalist. And then you have the other guy that nobody wants to talk about. Why? Because he wasn't a white nationalist. So it's not important to them. Now, as far as takedown MRAs is concerned, I don't know why everybody isn't doing this. I have an image that I've posted multiple times on my Twitter account. If you search my name and hashtag feminist logic and look at images, I'm sure you'll find it. And it shows that he's an idiot and a liar, okay? And it's just basically an image regarding homelessness and shelters and men's shelters. He basically attributed homeless shelters as men's shelters, you know, that you can go to for 3 days, as an equivalent to women's shelters that are for domestic violence victims that you can go to for almost a month if you're a woman. And every time he says anything, just post that image in response, you know, and just he'll shut up. He's just you prove that he's an idiot and a liar. He runs away. He absolutely hates that. He hates having it documented that he doesn't think things through, and that his logic is unsound, and that he doesn't have his facts straight. And that's basically the way to handle him. If you get into an argument with him, he is going to get you suspended from Twitter. If you get into an argument with him and you maintain an argument with him, he will eventually get you permabanned. I would suggest you go on Twitter and ask Jack Barnes, but you can't, because they targeted Jack a couple of years ago and got him removed really fairly easily. So I, as far as, you know, his importance and the things that he says, nobody but his own buddies take anything that he says as any kind of factual statement. Pretty much everybody else that he talks to, he pisses them off enough and lies to them enough and says enough stupid things in front of them that everybody else knows that he's a liar and an idiot. So I wouldn't bother trying to convince him of anything or even win an argument with him in a Twitter thread. Just demonstrate that he's stupid and get him to block you and leave it at that. Pretty soon he'll have half the internet blocked. He'll be competing with Steve Shives for a block list.
Okay, so sorry for if it did drop out on your guys' end a couple times. I know there was a couple of hiccups, but I don't know what it is. So I'll have to look into it later. I can't explain it right now. But we got the last story, though, so let us know what you guys think about the story in the low bar. Last thing we're going to be talking about is, it's pretty silly, but let's go over to the PowerPoint. And we're looking at handshakes could be banned in workplaces. An associate director of advisory of HR consultancy firm Peninsula says that companies may start banning all forms of physical contact. Kate Palmer says that the hashtag MeToo era has forced companies to reevaluate their policies. She said to Metro the following, quote, some employers may put a complete ban on physical contact. Whether that's going too far or not is a question I would pose because it's contextual. Does shaking someone's hand go too far? They may just say, quote, no contact at all, quote, end quote, because there's no gray area. She said that a handshake is probably safe unless a company policy bans it. Total Jobs conducted a survey of 2,000 people and found that 75% of respondents want a ban. 75% of respondents want a ban on all physical contact. Palmer also says that context and different industries also affect appropriateness of physical contact. Do it. I say do it. Fuck it. Let's just go all the way. Let's get rid of all of the contact.
Isn't this how they do it in China or Japan, where they sort of bow instead of handshake? Isn't that sort of... it's a bit more normal over there, where they give many more fucks about hygiene than we do here.
Yeah, so in the 75% study, because I'm being asked, I was wondering about this, like, is it... you know, is it mostly men filling out the form? Is it mostly women filling out the form? Is it management? Is it employees? My understanding is it's employees, and it's likely mostly men. And I wouldn't be surprised if men were like, you know what, this isn't worth it. But I'll look into it while you guys give your opinions on the story.
Well, can I just really quick point out the hilarity of the fact that a person talking about banning handshakes is named Palmer? But no, this is just an end result of feminist bullshit. I mean, really, we're actually talking about banning the thing that people have done throughout history to demonstrate that they are harmless. Handshakes evolved out of, hey, I don't have a weapon in my hand. Do you have a weapon in your hand? You know, that's where it came from. It was supposed to demonstrate good faith. And now we're treating it like a form of assault. I mean, how dumb can we get with this?
I don't know. I mean, I doubt that this is actually going to become a thing where they're going to actually ban handshakes. But I think it's telling that the Me Too movement has that had an effect, that this is even a conversation that we're having. Like, unironically, we're talking about this. And that says a lot.
Yeah, years ago, this would have been The Onion. You know, because of feminism, we have to ban handshakes. Now it's serious. Now we're actually...
Welcome to Onion World. This is really what's going on.
Yep, Clown World. We've gone way past Clown World.
Yeah, that's right. So I couldn't find the study. Let's see, it doesn't actually have a citation. There was just a study supposedly conducted, and 75% said yes. So God knows what that means. We don't know. We'd have to look into it. But that's where we are. That's where we are. And even the even the Onion isn't as funny as real life right now. It's not nearly as funny, in fact. Does anybody else have any? I don't know what else to say. Handshakes might get banned in some companies. That's all I can say. Miles Kinslow gives us $10 and says, hey guys, should companies form gender segregated workplaces now? This is getting ridiculous. But yeah, like, it might be a good idea, but I seriously doubt that people go do that because it would be considered sexist. So we can't do that. We have to essentially... we just have to make sure that men are not allowed to touch, look at, talk to, or interact with women at all, but also they have to work with them, and also they have to give them all of the management positions and let them run the company, but don't make them do too much emotional labor. Make sure that they get all of the vacation time. Like, if they feel pregnant that day, they should be able to go home. But don't forget that some women have, you know, a cock and balls, And those women should also get maternity leave because we don't want to be transphobic. Yeah, so and that's a start. I think we'll be, but we'll have a long way to go if we address those issues. That's what I think we'll probably, that's the path we should go down if we want to make companies safe again. So.
And of course, that will definitely help productivity in numerous ways that we just can't think of right now.
Productivity is a product of the patriarchy, and we should
definitely
be productive. So, yeah.
Well, of course, no. Workplaces don't exist for any reason other than to create jobs, right?
All they do is men go there. It's a big building. A man walks in and he comes out with handfuls of money. That's basically all it is. And women should be able to walk in and walk out with handfuls of money too, and not 77 cents on the dollar either. Damn it. But yeah, gender segregated workplaces, I think in a lot of ways it can make sense, but I don't think that people want to have that conversation. That's honestly what I believe. I think that that's something that we should be able to talk about and should talk about, especially if we're concerned about women's, I guess, their sensibilities. But we can't because it would be sexist. So we have to, if it doesn't involve women never, ever having to take responsibility or change any of their normal habits or behaviors or clothes or attitudes or right or their comfort at the expense of all of men's goals and, you know, practices and productivity and their comfort, if we're not making that power shift, then it's probably sexist. So we should probably be conditioning our boys to better serve women in the business place, in the workplace. So, but any other thoughts on this handshake story? As ridiculous as it is. Okay. Well, I guess with that said, I'm going to wrap up. We'll have to figure out whatever this issue with the internet is. It could be YouTube. It could be Discord. It could be me. It could be Hannah. It doesn't matter. I want to thank Hannah and Mike for coming on with me. We're going to go into the after show to look at this article from Arwa Madawi, who is clearly more feminist than anyone because she's female and a woman of color, and she's probably a lesbian. And she writes, Bernie Sanders is the most feminist 2020 candidate as far as I'm concerned. Ooh, Sanders is far from perfect, but it is ridiculous to claim that he is beloved purely by arrogant white bros. He can't have that. I'm not going to give him that. He can't have that. He can't have that. IKissBBW09 asks, Mike, how is your dollhouse doing? Mike, how's your dollhouse doing?
That's rather a personal question. Was that a euphemism or not?
I don't know. I figured it was an inside joke or something that I didn't get. So, but yeah, so that was, I just relay the information. I've done that. Now we're going to move on. So if you want to be a part of this, you have to basically go over to feedthebadger.com and start a monthly subscription. You can join us in the after show where I will read through this article and we'll stop and discuss it as, you know, as we go along. So be sure to do that. That's feedthebadger.com. It links in the low bar, and it's also like scrolling across the bottom of the screen there. In the meantime, we're going to head over to the after show. So I want to thank Mike and Hannah for coming on. I want to thank you guys for coming on and also your patience with our sort of audio and internet issues. I will look into it. I don't know if it's something that's on my end. Sometimes there's just issues and they come from the ether. I don't know why. So hopefully, you know, this will be something that we can resolve quite easily and quickly. So with that said, please give this video a like. Be sure to comment on the stories and so on, and ring the bell for notifications if you're already subscribed. And if you're not, then please do subscribe. Also, consider maybe bookmarking this channel, this page, because just the homepage or whatever, because apparently sometimes the notifications don't go through either. And we're kind of running out of options as far as like how to communicate to you guys when our shows go live. You could also follow us on Twitch instead, which probably hasn't thrown us under the bus yet. Or you can go do so on, I believe we're on a lot of other platforms. We're on Ustream. We're on Facebook. You know, there's a few places. So follow us on any of those areas. And yeah, that way you know when our videos go live. So I want to thank you guys for coming on the HBR News Show. Once again, have a great evening, everybody.